Blackish. 1. Although Hodges has officially made Holly a full partner in Finders Keepers, and there's a spare office, small but with a street view, she has elected to remain based in the reception area. She's seated there, peering at the screen of her computer when Hodges comes in at 10:45. And although she's quick to sweep something into the wide drawer above the knee hole of her desk, Hodges' olfactories are still in good working order, unlike some of his malfunctioning equipment further south, and he catches an unmistakable whiff of half-eaten Twinkie. What's the story, Holly Berry?
You pick that up from Jerome, and you know I hate it. Call me Holly Berry again, and I'll go see my mother for a week. She keeps asking me to visit.
As if, Hodges thinks, you can't stand her. And besides, you're on the scent, my dear, as hooked as a heroin addict. Sorry. He looks over her shoulder and sees an article from Bloomberg Business dated April of 2014. The headline reads, Zap It, Zapped. Yeah, the company screwed the pooch and stepped out the door. Thought I told you that yesterday.
You did. What's interesting, to me at least, is the inventory.
What do you mean?
Thousands of unsold Zappets. Maybe tens of thousands. I wanted to know what happened to them.
And did you find out?
Not yet.
Maybe they got shipped to the poor children in China along with all the vegetables I refused to eat as a child.
Starving children are not funny, she says, looking severe.
No, of course not. Hodges straightens up. He filled a prescription for painkillers on his way back from Stamos's office, heavy duty but not as heavy as the stuff he may be taking soon, and he feels almost okay. There's even a faint stirring of hunger in his belly, which is a welcome change. They were probably destroyed. That's what they do with unsold paperback books, I think.
That's a lot of inventory to destroy, she says, considering the gadgets are loaded with games and still work. The top of the line, the commanders, even came equipped with Wi-Fi. Now tell me about your tests.
Hodges manufactures a smile he hopes will look both modest and happy. Good news, actually. It's an ulcer, but just a little one. I'll have to take a bunch of pills and be careful about my diet. Dr. Stamos says if I do that, it should heal on its own.
She gives him a radiant smile that makes Hodges feel good about this outrageous lie.
Of course, it also makes him feel like dog shit on an old shoe.
Thank God. You'll do what he says, won't you?
You bet. More dog shit. All the bland food in the world won't cure what ails him. Hodges is not a giver-upper, and under other circumstances, he would be in the office of gastroenterologist Henry Yip right now, no matter how bad the odds of beating pancreatic cancer. The message he received on the Blue Umbrella site has changed things, however.
Well, that's fine, because I don't know what I'd do without you, Bill. I just don't.
Holly?
Actually, I do. I'd go back home, and that would be bad for me.
No shit, Hodges thinks. The first time I met you in town for your Aunt Elizabeth's funeral, your mom was practically leading you around like a mutt on a leash. Do this, Holly, do that, Holly. And for Christ's sake, don't do anything embarrassing.
Now, tell me, she says. Tell me there's something new. Tell me.
Give me 15 minutes, then I'll spill everything. In the meantime, see if you can find out what happened to all those commander consoles. It's probably not important, but it might be.
Okay. Wonderful news about your tests, Bill.
Yeah. He goes into his office. Holly swivels her chair to look after him for a moment, because he rarely closes the door when he's in there. Still, it's not unheard of. She returns to her computer.
2. He's not done with you yet.
Holly repeats it in a soft voice. She puts her half-eaten veggie burger down on its paper plate. Hodges has already demolished his, talking between bites. He doesn't mention waking with pain. In this version, he discovered the message because he got up to net surf when he couldn't sleep. That's what it said, all right.
From Z-Boy.
Yeah. Sounds like some superhero sidekick, doesn't it? Follow the adventures of Z-Man and Z-Boy as they keep the streets of Gotham City safe from crime.
That's Batman and Robin. They're the ones who patrol Gotham City.
I know that. I was reading Batman comics before you were born. I was just saying.
She picks up her veggie burger, extracts a shred of lettuce, puts it down again. When is the last time you visited Brady Hartsfield?
Right to the heart of the matter, Hodges thinks admiringly. That's my Holly. I went to see him just after the business with the Saubers family, and once more later on. Midsummer, that would have been. Then you and Jerome cornered me and said I had to stop, so I did.
We did it for your own good.
I know that, Holly. Now eat your sandwich. She takes a bite, dabs mayo from the corner of her mouth, and asks him how Hartsfield seemed on his last visit. The same, mostly. Just sitting there, looking out at the parking garage. I talk, I ask him questions, he says nothing. He gives Academy Award brain damage, no doubt about that. But there have been stories about him, that he has some kind of mind power. That he can turn the water on and off in his bathroom and does it sometimes to scare the staff. I'd call it bullshit, but when Becky Helmington was the head nurse, she said she'd actually seen stuff on a couple of occasions. Rattling blinds, the TV going on by itself, the bottles on his IV stand swinging back and forth. And she's what I'd call a credible witness. I know it's hard to believe.
Not so hard. Telekinesis, sometimes called psychokinesis, is a documented phenomenon. You never saw anything like that yourself during any of your visits?
Well, he pauses, remembering. Something did happen on my second-to-last visit. There was a picture on the table beside his bed. Him and his mother with their arms around each other and their cheeks pressed together. On vacation somewhere. There was a bigger version in the house on Elm Street. You probably remember it.
Of course I do. I remember everything we saw in that house, including some of the cheesecake photos of her he had on his computer. She crosses her arms over her small bosom and makes a moo of distaste. That was a very unnatural relationship.
Tell me about it. I don't know if he ever actually had sex with her.
Oof.
But I think he probably wanted to, and at the very least, she enabled his fantasies. Anyway, I grab the picture and talk some smack about her, trying to get a rise out of him, trying to get him to respond. Because he's in there, Holly, and I mean all present and accounted for. I was sure of it then, and I'm sure of it now. He just sits there. But inside, he's the same human wasp that killed those people at City Center and tried to kill a whole lot more at Mingo Auditorium.
And he used Debbie's blue umbrella to talk with you. Don't forget that.
After last night, I'm not likely to.
Tell me the rest of what happened that time.
For just a second, he stopped looking out his window at the parking garage across the way. His eyes, they rolled in their sockets, and he looked at me. Every hair on the nape of my neck stood up at attention, and the air felt, I don't know, electric. He forces himself to say the rest. It's like pushing a big rock up a steep hill. I arrested some bad doers when I was on the cops, some very bad doers. One was a mother who killed her 3-year-old for insurance that didn't amount to a hill of beans. But I never felt the presence of evil in any of them once they were caught. It's like evil's some kind of vulture that flies away once these mokes are locked up. But I felt it that day, Holly. I really did. I felt it in Brady Hartsfield.
I believe you, she says in a voice so small it's barely a whisper.
And he had a zappit. That's the connection I was trying to make, if it is a connection and not just a coincidence. There was a guy, I don't know his last name, everyone just called him Library Al, who used to hand Zappits out along with Kindles and paperbacks when he made his rounds. I don't know if Al was an orderly or a volunteer. Hell, he might even have been one of the janitors doing a little good deed on the side. I think the only reason I didn't pick up on that right away was the Zappit you found at the Ellerton house was pink. The one in Brady's room was blue.
How could what happened to Janice Ellerton and her daughter have anything to do with Brady Hartsfield? Unless, has anyone reported any telekinetic activity outside of his room? Have there been rumors of that?
Nope. But right around the time the Saubers business finished up, a nurse committed suicide in the brain injury clinic. sliced her wrists in a bathroom right down the hall from Hartsfield's room. Her name was Sadie McDonald.
Are you thinking? She's picking at her sandwich again, shredding the lettuce and dropping it onto her plate, waiting for him.
Go on, Holly. I'm not going to say it for you.
You're thinking Brady talked her into it somehow? I don't see how that could be possible.
I don't either, but we know Brady has a fascination with suicide.
This Sadie McDonald, did she happen to have one of those Zap-It things?
God knows.
How did...
This time he does help. With a scalpel she filched from one of the surgical suites. I got that from the ME's assistant. Slipped her a gift card to DiMaggio's, the Italian joint.
Holly shreds more lettuce.
Her plate is starting to look like confetti at a leprechaun birthday party. It's driving Hodges a little nuts, but it doesn't stop her. She's working her way up to saying it, and finally does.
You're going to see Hartsfield?
Yeah, I am.
Do you really think you'll get anything out of him? You never have before.
I know a little more now. But what really does he know? He's not even sure what he suspects. But maybe Hartsfield isn't a human wasp after all. Maybe he's a spider, and room 217 at the bucket is the center of his web where he sits spinning. Or maybe it's all coincidence. Maybe the cancer is already eating into my brain, sparking a lot of paranoid ideas. That's what Pete would think, and his partner, hard to stop thinking of her as Miss Pretty Gray Eyes now that it's in his head, would say it right out loud. He stands up. No time like the present. She drops her sandwich onto the pile of mangled lettuce so she can grasp his arm.
Be careful.
I will.
Guard your thoughts. I know how crazy that sounds, but I am crazy, at least some of the time, so I can say it. If you should have any ideas about, well, harming yourself, call me. Call me right away.
Okay. She crosses her arms and grasps her shoulders. That old fretful gesture he sees less often now.
I wish Jerome was here.
Jerome Robinson is in Arizona taking a semester off from college, building houses as part of a Habitat for Humanity crew. Once when Hodges used the phrase garnishing his resume in relation to this activity, Holly scolded him, telling him Jerome was doing it because he was a good person. With that, Hodges has to agree. Jerome really is a good person. I'm going to be fine. And this is probably nothing. We're like kids worrying that the empty house on the corner is haunted. If we said anything about it to Pete, he'd have us both committed.
Holly, who actually has been committed twice, believes some empty houses really might be haunted. She removes one small and ringless hand from one shoulder long enough to grasp his arm again, this time by the sleeve of his overcoat. Call me when you get there, and call me again when you leave. Don't forget. Because I'll be worrying, and I can't call you, because...
No cell phones allowed in the bucket, yeah, I know. I'll do it, Holly. In the meantime, I've got a couple of things for you.
He sees her hand dart toward a notepad and shakes his head.
No, you don't need to write this down. It's simple. First, go on eBay or wherever you go to buy stuff that's no longer available retail and order one of those Zap-It commanders. Can you do that?
Easy. What's the other thing?
Sunrise Solutions bought out Zap-It, then went bankrupt. Someone will be serving as the trustee in bankruptcy. The trustee hires lawyers, accountants, and liquidators to help squeeze every cent out of the company. Get a name, and I'll make a call later today or tomorrow. I want to know what happened to all those unsold Zap-It consoles, because somebody gave one to Janice Ellerton a long time after both companies were out of business.
She lights up. That's fracking brilliant.
Not brilliant, just police work, he thinks. I may have terminal cancer, but I still remember how the job is done, and that's something. That's something good. 3. As he exits the Turner building and heads for the bus stop, the number 5 is a quicker and easier way to get across town than retrieving his Prius and driving himself, Hodges is a deeply preoccupied man. He is thinking about how he should approach Brady, how he can open him up. He was an ace in the interrogation room when he was on the job, so there has to be a way. Previously, he's only gone to Brady to goad him and confirm his gut belief that Brady is faking his semi-catatonic state. Now he has some real questions, and there must be some way he can get Brady to answer them. I have to poke the spider, he thinks. Interfering with his efforts to plan the forthcoming confrontation are thoughts of the diagnosis he's just received and the inevitable fears that go with it. For his life, yes, but there are also questions of how much he may suffer a bit farther down the line and how he will inform those who need to know. Corrine and Allie will be shaken up by the news, but basically okay. The same goes for the Robinson family, although he knows Jerome and Barbara, his kid sister, not such a kid now, she'll turn 16 in a few months, will take it hard. Mostly, though, it's Holly he worries about. She isn't crazy, despite what she said in the office, but she's fragile. Very. She's had two breakdowns in her past, one in high school and one in her early 20s. She's stronger now. But her main sources of support over these last few years have been him and the little company they run together. If they go, she'll be at risk. He can't afford to kid himself about that. I won't let her break, Hodges thinks. He walks with his head down and his hands stuffed in his pockets, blowing out white vapor. I can't let that happen. Deep in these thoughts, he misses the primer-spotted Chevy Malibu for the third time in 2 days. It's parked up the street, opposite the building, where Holly is now hunting down the Sunrise Solutions bankruptcy trustee. Standing on the sidewalk next to it is an elderly man in an old army surplus parka that has been mended with masking tape. He watches Hodges get on the bus, then takes a cell phone from his coat pocket and makes a call. 4. Holly watches her boss, who happens to be the person she loves most in the world, walk to the bus stop on the corner. He looks so slight now, almost a shadow of the burly man she first met 6 years ago. And he has his hand pressed to his side as he walks. He does that a lot lately, and she doesn't think he's even aware of it. Nothing but a small ulcer, he said. She'd like to believe that. Would like to believe him, which she's not sure she does. The bus comes, and Bill gets on. Holly stands by the window, watching it go, gnawing at her fingernails, wishing for a cigarette. She has Nicorette gum, plenty of it, but sometimes only a cigarette will do. Quit wasting time, she tells herself. If you really mean to be a rotten, dirty sneak, there's no time like the present. So she goes into his office. His computer is dark, but he never turns it off until he goes home at night. All she has to do is refresh the screen. Before she can, her eye is caught by the yellow legal pad beside the keyboard. He always has one handy, usually covered with notes and doodles. It's how he thinks. Written at the top of this one is a line she knows well, one that has resonated with her ever since she first heard the song on the radio. All the lonely people. He has underlined it. Beneath are names she knows. Olivia Trelawney, widowed. Martine Stover, unmarried. Housekeeper called her spinster. Janice Ellerton, widowed. Nancy Alderson, widowed. And others. Her own, of course. She is also a spinster. Pete Huntley, who's divorced. And Hodges himself, also divorced. Single people are twice as likely to commit suicide. Divorced people, 4 times as likely. Brady Hartsfield enjoyed suicide, she murmurs. It was his hobby. Below the name circled is a jotted note she doesn't understand. Visitors list? What visitors? She hits a random key, and Bill's computer lights up, showing his desktop screen with all his files scattered helter-skelter across it. She has scolded him about this time and again, has told him it's like leaving the door of your house unlocked and your valuables all laid out on the dining room table with a sign on them saying, "Please steal me." And he always says he will do better, and he never does. Not that it would have changed things in Holly's case, because she also has his password.
He gave it to her himself, in case something ever happened to him, he said. Now she's afraid something has. One look at the screen is enough to tell her the something is no ulcer. There's a new file folder there, one with a scary title. Holly clicks on it. The terrible Gothic letters at the top are enough to confirm that the document is indeed the last will and testament of one Kermit William Hodges. She closes it at once. She has absolutely no desire to paw through his bequests. Knowing that such a document exists and that he has been reviewing it this very day is enough. Too much, actually. She stands there, clutching at her shoulders and nibbling her lips. The next step would be worse than snooping. It would be prying. It would be burglary. You've come this far, so go ahead. Yes, I have to, Holly whispers, and clicks on the postage stamp icon that opens his email, telling herself there will probably be nothing. Only there is. The most recent message likely came in while they were talking about what he found early this morning under Debbie's blue umbrella. It's from the doctor he went to see. Stamos, his name is. She opens the email and reads, "Here is a copy of your most recent test results for your files." Holly uses the password in the email to open the attachment, sits in Bill's chair, and leans forward, her hands clenched tightly in her lap. By the time she scrolls down to the second of the 8 pages, she is crying.
5. Hodges is no more than settled in his seat at the back of the number 5 when glass breaks in his coat pocket and the boys cheer the home run that just broke Mrs. O'Leary's living room window. A man in a business suit lowers his Wall Street Journal and looks disapprovingly at Hodges over the top of it. Sorry, Hodges says. Keep meaning to change it.
You should make it a priority, the businessman says and raises his paper again.
The text is from his old partner. Again, feeling a strong sense of deja vu, Hodges calls him.
Pete, he says, what's with all the texts? It isn't as if you don't have my number on speed dial.
Figured Holly probably programmed your phone for you and put on some crazy ringtone, Pete says. That'd be her idea of a real knee slapper. Also figured you'd have it turned up to max volume, you deaf son of a bitch.
The text alerts the one on max, Hodges says. When I get a call, the phone just has a mini orgasm against my leg.
Change the alert, then.
Hours ago, he found out he has only months to live. Now he's discussing the volume of his cell phone.
I'll absolutely do that. Now tell me why you called. Got a guy in computer forensics who landed on that game gadget like a fly on shit. He loved it. Called it retro. Can you believe that? Gadget was probably manufactured all of 5 years ago, and now it's retro.
The world is speeding up.
It's sure doing something. Anyway, the Zap-It is zapped. When our guy plugged in fresh batteries, it popped half a dozen bright blue flashes, then died.
What's wrong with it?
Some kind of virus is technically possible. The thing supposedly has Wi-Fi, and that's mostly how those bugs get downloaded. But he says it's more likely a bad chip or a fried circuit. The point is, it means nothing. Ellerton couldn't have used it.
Then why did she keep the charger cord for it plugged in right there in her daughter's bathroom? That silences Pete for a moment. Then he says,
okay, so maybe it worked for a while and then the chip died, or whatever they do.
It worked all right, Hodges thinks. She played solitaire on it at the kitchen table. Lots of different kinds, like Klondike and Pyramid and Picture, which you would know, Peter, my dear, if you'd talked to Nancy Alderson. That must still be on your bucket list.
All right, Hodges says. Thanks for the update. It's your final update, Kermit. I have a partner I've worked with quite successfully since you pulled the pin, and I'd like her to be at my retirement party instead of sitting at her desk and sulking over how I preferred you to her right to the bitter end.
Hodges could pursue this, but the hospital is only 2 stops away now. Also, he discovers, he wants to separate himself from Pete and Izzy and go his own way on this thing. Pete plods, and Izzy actually drags her feet. Hodges wants to run with it, bad pancreas and all.
I hear you, he says. Again, thanks. Case closed?
Finito. His eyes flick up and to the left.
6. 19 blocks from where Hodges is returning his iPhone to his overcoat pocket, there is another world. Not a very nice one. Jerome Robinson's sister is there, and she is in trouble. Pretty and demure in her Chapel Ridge school uniform, gray wool coat, gray skirt, white knee socks, red scarf wrapped around her neck, Barbara walks down Martin Luther King Avenue with a yellow Zap-It Commander in her gloved hands. On it, the fishing hole fish dart and swim, although they are almost invisible in the cold, bright light of midday.
MLK is one of two main thoroughfares in the part of the city known as Lowtown, and although the population is predominantly black and Barbara is herself black, make that café au lait, she has never been here before, and that single fact makes her feel stupid and worthless. These are her people. Their collective ancestors might have toted barges and lifted bales on the same plantation back in the day for all she knows, and yet she has never been here one single time. She has been warned away not only by her parents, but by her brother. Lowtown's where they drink the beer and then eat the bottle it came in, he told her once. No place for a girl like you.
A girl like me, she thinks. A nice upper-middle-class girl like me, who goes to a nice private school and has nice white girlfriends and plenty of nice preppy clothes and an allowance. Why, I even have a bank card. I can withdraw $60 from an ATM anytime I want. Amazeballs. She walks like a girl in a dream. And it's a little like a dream, because it's all so strange, and it's less than 2 miles from home, which happens to be a cozy Cape Cod with an attached two-car garage, mortgage all paid off. She walks past check-cashing joints and pawn shops filled with guitars and radios and gleaming pearl-handled straight razors. She walks past bars that smell of beer even when the doors closed against the January cold. She walks past hole-in-the-wall restaurants that smell of grease. Some sell pizza by the slice. Some sell Chinese. In the window of one is a propped sign reading, "Hush puppies and collard greens like your mama used to make." Not my mama, Barbara thinks. I don't even know what a collard green is. Spinach? Cabbage? On the corners, every corner it seems, boys in long shorts and loose jeans are hanging out, sometimes standing close to rusty fire barrels to keep warm, sometimes playing hacky sack, sometimes just jiving in their gigantic sneakers, their jackets hung open in spite of the cold. They shout yo to their homies and hail passing cars, and when one stops, they hand small glassine envelopes through the open window. She walks block after block of MLK. 9, 10, maybe a dozen, she's lost count, and each corner is like a drive-through for drugs instead of for hamburgers or tacos. She passes shivering women dressed in hot pants, short fake fur jackets and shiny boots. On their heads, they wear amazing wigs of many colors. She passes empty buildings with boarded-up windows. She passes a car that has been stripped to the axles and covered with gang tags. She passes a woman with a dirty bandage over one eye. The woman is dragging a screeching toddler by the arm. She passes a man sitting on a blanket who drinks from a bottle of wine and wiggles his gray tongue at her. It's poor, and it's desperate. And it's been right here all along, and she never did anything about it. Never did anything? Never even thought about it. What she did was her homework. What she did was talk on the phone and text with her BFFs at night. What she did was update her Facebook status and worry about her complexion. She is your basic teen parasite, dining in nice restaurants with her mother and father while her brothers and sisters, right here, all along, less than 2 miles from her nice suburban home. drink wine, and take drugs to blot out their terrible lives. She is ashamed of her hair, hanging smoothly to her shoulders. She is ashamed of her clean white knee socks. She is ashamed of her skin color because it's the same as theirs.
Hey, Blackish!
It's a yell from the other side of the street.
What you doing down here? You got no business down here?
Blackish. It's the name of a TV show. They watch it at home and laugh, but it's also what she is. Not black, but blackish. Living a white life in a white neighborhood. She can do that because her parents make lots of money and own a home on a block where people are so screamingly non-prejudiced that they cringe if they hear one of their kids call another one dumbhead. She can live that wonderful white life because she is a threat to no one. She no rocket a boat. She just goes her way, chattering with her friends about boys and music and boys and clothes and boys and the TV programs they all like and which girl they saw walking with which boy at the Birch Hill Mall. She is blackish, a word that means the same as useless, and she doesn't deserve to live. Maybe you should just end it. Let that be your statement. The idea is a voice, and it comes to her with a kind of revelatory logic. Emily Dickinson said her poem was her letter to the world that never wrote to her. They read that in school, but Barbara herself has never written a letter at all. Plenty of stupid essays and book reports and emails, but nothing that really matters. Maybe it's time that you did. Not her voice, but the voice of a friend. She stops outside a shop where fortunes are read and the tarot is told. In its dirty window, she thinks she sees the reflection of someone standing beside her, a white man with a smiling, boyish face and a tumble of blonde hair on his forehead. She glances around, but there's no one there. It was just her imagination. She looks back down at the screen of the game console. In the shade of the fortune-telling shop's awning, the swimming fish are bright and clear again. Back and forth they go, every now and then obliterated by a bright blue flash. Barbara looks back the way she came and sees a gleaming black truck rolling toward her along the boulevard, moving fast and weaving from lane to lane. It's the kind with oversized tires, the kind the boys at school call a Bigfoot or a gangster large. If you're going to do it, you better get to it. It's as if someone really is standing beside her, someone who understands, and the voice is right. Barbara has never considered suicide before, but at this moment the idea seems perfectly rational. You don't even need to leave a note, her friend says. She can see his reflection in the window again. Ghostly. The fact that you did it down here will be your letter to the world.
True.
You know too much about yourself now to go on living, her friend points out as she returns her gaze to the swimming fish. You know too much, and all of it is bad. Then it hastens to add, which isn't to say you're a horrible person. She thinks,
no, not horrible. Just useless.
Blackish. The truck is coming, the gangsta large. As Jerome Robinson's sister steps toward the curb, ready to meet it, her face lights in an eager smile.
7. Dr. Felix Babineau is wearing a $1,000 suit beneath the white coat that goes flying out behind him as he strides down the hallway of the bucket. But he now needs a shave worse than ever, and his usually elegant white hair is in disarray. He ignores a cluster of nurses who are standing by the duty desk and talking in low, agitated tones. Nurse Wilmer approaches him.
Dr. Babineau, have you heard?
He doesn't even look at her, and Norma has to sidestep quickly to keep from being bowled over. She looks after him in surprise. Babineau takes the red Do Not Disturb card he always keeps in the pocket of his exam coat, hangs it on the doorknob of room 217, and goes in. Brady Hartsfield does not look up.
All of his attention is fixed on the game console in his lap, where the fish swim back and forth. There is no music. He has muted the sound. Often, when he enters this room, Felix Babineau disappears and Dr. Z takes his place. Not today. Dr. Z is just another version of Brady, after all, a projection, and today Brady is too busy to project. His memories of trying to blow up the Mingo Auditorium during the Round Here concert are still jumbled, but one thing has been clear since he woke up. The face of the last person he saw before the lights went out. It was Barbara Robinson, the sister of Hodges' nigger lawn boy. She was sitting almost directly across the aisle from Brady. Now she's here, swimming with the fish they share on their two screens. Brady got Scapelli, the sadistic cunt who twisted his nipple. Now he will take care of the Robinson bitch. Her death will hurt her big brother, but that's not the most important thing. It will put a dagger in the old detective's heart. That's the most important thing. The most delicious thing. He comforts her, tells her she's not a horrible person. It helps to get her moving. Something is coming down MLK. He can't be sure what it is because a down deep part of her is still fighting him, but it's big. Big enough to do the job.
Brady, listen to me. Z-Boy called.
Z-Boy's actual name is Brooks, but Brady refuses to call him that anymore.
He's been watching, as you instructed. That cop, ex-cop, whatever he is.
Shut up. Not raising his head, his hair tumbled across his brow. In the strong sunlight, he looks closer to 20 than 30.
Babineau, who is used to being heard and who still has not entirely grasped his new subordinate status, pays no attention. Hodges was on Hilltop Court yesterday, first at the Ellerton house and then snooping around the one across the street where—
I said shut up.
Brooks saw him get on a number 5 bus, which means he's probably coming here. And if he's coming here, he knows.
Brady looks at him for just a moment, his eyes blazing, then returns his attention to the screen. If he slips now, allows this educated idiot to divert his concentration, but he won't allow it. He wants to hurt Hodges. He wants to hurt the nigger lawn boy. He owes them, and this is the way to do it. Nor is it just a matter of revenge. She's the first test subject who was at the concert, and she's not like the others, who were easier to control. But he is controlling her. All he needs is 10 more seconds, and now he sees what's coming for her. It's a truck, a big black one. Hey, honey, Brady Hartsfield thinks. Your ride is here. 8. Barbara stands on the curb, watching the truck approach, timing it. But just as she flexes her knees, hands grab her from behind.
Hey, girl, what's up?
She struggles, but the grip on her shoulders is strong, and the truck passes by in a blare of Ghost Face Killer. She whirls around, pulling free, and faces a skinny boy about her own age, wearing a Todd Hunter High letter jacket. He's tall, maybe 6.5 feet, so she has to look up. He has a tight cap of brown curls and a goatee. Around his neck is a thin gold chain. He's smiling. His eyes are green and full of fun.
You good looking. That's a fact as well as a compliment. But not from around here, correct? Not dressed like that. And hey, didn't your mom ever tell you not to jaywalk the block?
Leave me alone. She's not scared. She's furious. He laughs.
And tough. I like a tough girl. Want a slice and a Coke?
I don't want anything from you.
Her friend has left, probably disgusted with her. It's not my fault, she thinks. It's this boy's fault. This lout. Lout. A blackish word, if ever there was one. She feels her face heat up and drops her gaze to the fish on the Zap-It screen. They will comfort her. They always do. To think she almost threw the game console away after that man gave it to her. Before she found the fish. The fish always take her away. And sometimes they bring her friend. But she only gets a momentary look before the console vanishes. Poof, gone.
The lout has got it in his long-fingered hands and is staring down at the screen, fascinated.
Whoa, this is old school.
It's mine, Barbara shouts. Give it back. Across the street, a woman laughs and yells in a whiskey voice,
Tell him, sister. Bring down that hard neck.
Barbara grabs for the zappet. Tallboy holds it over his head, smiling at her.
Give it back, I said. Stop being a prick.
More people are watching now, and Tallboy plays to the audience. He jinks left, then stutter steps to the right. Probably a move he uses all the time on the basketball court, never losing that indulgent smile. His green eyes sparkle and dance. Every girl at Todd Hunter is probably in love with those eyes, and Barbara is no longer thinking about suicide or being blackish or what a socially unconscious bag of waste she is. Right now, she's only mad, and him being cute makes her madder. She plays varsity soccer at Chapel Ridge, and now she hoiks her best penalty kick into Tallboy's shin. He yells in pain, but it's somehow amused pain, which infuriates her even more because that was a really hard kick, and bends over to grab his ouchie. It brings him down to her level, and Barbara snatches the precious rectangle of yellow plastic. She wheels, skirt flaring, and runs into the street.
Honey, look out!
The whiskey-voiced woman screams. Barbara hears a shriek of brakes and smells hot rubber. She looks to her left and sees a panel truck bearing down on her, the front end heeling to the left as the driver stamps on the brake. Behind the dirty windshield, his face is all dismayed eyes and open mouth. She throws up her hands, dropping the zappet. All at once, the last thing in the world Barbara Robinson wants is to die. But here she is, in the street, after all, and it's too late. She thinks, my ride is here.
9. Brady shuts down the zappet and looks up at Babineau with a wide smile.
Got her, he says. His words are clear, not the slightest bit mushy. Let's see how Hodges and the Harvard Jungle Bunny like that.
Babineau has a good idea who she is, and he supposes he should care, but he doesn't. What he cares about is his own skin. How did he ever allow Brady to pull him into this? When did he stop having a choice?
It's Hodges I'm here about. I'm quite sure he's on his way right now to see you.
Hodges has been here many times, Brady says, although it's true the old debt rat hasn't been around for a while. He never gets past the catatonic act.
He's started putting things together. He's not stupid. You said as much yourself.
Did he know Z-Boy when he was just Brooks? He must have seen him around here when he came to visit you.
No idea. Brady is wrung out, sated. What he really wants now is to savor the death of the Robinson girl, then take a nap. There's a lot to be done. Great things are afoot. But at the moment, he needs rest.
He can't see you like this, Babineau says. Your skin is flushed, and you're covered with sweat. You look like someone who just ran the city marathon.
Then keep him out. You can do that. You're the doctor, and he's just another half-bald buzzard on Social Security. These days, he doesn't even have the legal authority to ticket a car at an expired parking meter. Brady's wondering how the nigger lawn boy will take the news. Jerome. Will he cry? Will he sink to his knees? Will he rend his garments and beat his breast? Will he blame Hodges? Unlikely, but that would be best. That would be wonderful.
All right, Babineau says. Yes, you're right. I can do that.
He's talking to himself as much as to the man who was supposed to be his guinea pig. That turned out to be quite the joke, didn't it?
For now, at least. But he must still have friends on the police, you know. Probably lots of them.
I'm not afraid of them, and I'm not afraid of him. I just don't want to see him. At least not now, Brady smiles. After he finds out about the girl, then I want to see him. Now get out of here.
Babineau, who is at last beginning to understand who is the boss, leaves Brady's room. As always, it's a relief to do that as himself.
because every time he comes back to Babineau after being Dr. Z, there's a little less Babineau to come back to.
10.
Tanya Robinson calls her daughter's cell for the fourth time in the last 20 minutes, and for the fourth time gets nothing but Barbara's chirpy voicemail. "Disregard my other messages," Tanya says after the beep. "I'm still mad, but mostly what I am right now is worried sick. Call me. I need to know you're okay." She drops her phone on her desk and begins pacing the small confines of her office. She debates calling her husband and decides not to. Not yet. He's apt to go nuclear at the thought of Barbara skipping school, and he'll assume that's what she's doing. Tanya at first made that assumption herself when Mrs. Rossi, the Chapel Ridge attendance officer, called to ask if Barbara was homesick. Barbara has never played hooky before, but there's always a first time for bad behavior, especially with teenagers. Only she never would have skipped alone, and after further consultation with Mrs. Rossi, Tanya has confirmed that all of Barb's close friends are in school today. Since then, her mind has turned to darker thoughts, and one image keeps haunting her. The sign over the crosstown expressway the police use for amber alerts. She keeps seeing Barbara Robinson on that sign, flashing on and off like some hellish movie marquee. Her phone chimes the first few notes of Ode to Joy, and she races to it, thinking, "Thank God. Oh, thank God. I'll ground her for the rest of the win." Only it's not her daughter's smiling face in the window. It's an ID. City Police Department, Main Branch. Terror rolls through her stomach and her bowels loosen. For a moment, she can't even take the call because her thumb won't move. At last, she manages to press the green accept button and silence the music. Everything in her office, especially the family photo on her desk, is too bright. The phone seems to float up to her ear. "Hello?" She listens. "Yes, this is she." She listens, her free hand rising to cover her mouth and stifle whatever sound wants to come out. She hears herself ask, "Are you sure it's my daughter? Barbara Rosellen Robinson?" The policeman who has called to notify her says yes. He's sure. They found her ID in the street. What he doesn't tell her is that they had to wipe off the blood to see the name.
11. Hodges knows something's amiss as soon as he steps out of the skyway that connects Kiner Memorial proper to the Lakes Region Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic, where the walls are painted a soothing pink and soft music plays day and night. The usual patterns have been disrupted, and very little work seems to be getting done. Lunch carts stand marooned, filled with congealing plates of noodly stuff that might once have been the cafeteria's idea of Chinese. Nurses cluster, murmuring in low tones. One appears to be crying. Two interns have their heads together by the water fountain. An orderly is talking on his cell phone, which is technically cause for suspension, but Hodges thinks he's safe enough. No one is paying him any mind. At least Ruth Scapelli is nowhere in sight, which might improve his chances of getting in to see Hartsfield. It's Norma Wilmer at the duty desk, and along with Becky Helmington, Norma was his source for all things Brady before Hodges quit visiting room 217. The bad news is that Hartsfield's doctor is also at the duty desk. Hodges has never been able to establish a rapport with him, although God knows he's tried. He ambles down to the water fountain, hoping Babineau hasn't spotted him and will soon be off to look at PET scans or something, leaving Wilmer alone and approachable. He gets a drink, wincing and placing a hand to his side as he straightens up, then speaks to the interns. "Is something going on here? The place seems a little riled up." They hesitate and glance at each other.
"Can't talk about it," says intern one. He still has the remains of his adolescent acne and looks about 17. Hodges shudders at the thought of him assisting in a surgery job more difficult than removing a thumb splinter.
"Something with a patient? Hartsfield, maybe? I only ask because I used to be a cop and I'm sort of responsible for putting him here."
"Hodges," says intern two, "is that your name?"
"Yeah, that's me."
"You caught him, right?"
Hodges agrees instantly, although if it had been left up to him, Brady would have bagged a lot more in Mingo Auditorium than he managed to get at City Center. No, it was Holly and Jerome Robinson who stopped Brady before he could detonate his devil's load of homemade plastic explosive. The interns exchange another glance, and then one says,
"Hearts feels the same as ever, just gorking along. It's Nurse Ratchet."
Intern two gives him an elbow. "Speak no ill of the dead, asshole, especially when the guy listening might have loose lips." Hodges immediately runs a thumbnail across his mouth as if sealing his dangerous lips shut. Intern one looks flustered.
"Head Nurse Scapelli, I mean. She committed suicide last night."
All the lights in Hodges' head come on, and for the first time since yesterday, he forgets that he's probably going to die. "Are you sure?"
"Sliced her arms and wrists and bled out," says Two. "That's what I'm hearing, anyway."
"Did she leave a note?" They have no idea. Hodges heads for the duty desk. Babineau is still there, going over files with Wilmer, who looks flustered at her apparent battlefield promotion, but he can't wait. This is Hartsfield's dirt. He doesn't know how that can be, but it has Brady written all over it. The fucking suicide prince.
He almost calls Nurse Wilmer by her first name, but instinct makes him shy from that at the last moment.
"Nurse Wilmer, I'm Bill Hodges," a thing she knows very well.
"I worked both the City Center case and the Mingo Auditorium thing. I need to see Mr. Hartsfield."
She opens her mouth, but Babineau is there ahead of her.
"Out of the question. Even if Mr. Hartsfield were allowed visitors, which he is not by order of the district attorney's office, he wouldn't be allowed to see you. He needs peace and calm. Each of your previous unauthorized visits has shattered that."
"News to me," Hodges says mildly. "Every time I've been to see him, he just sits there, bland as a bowl of oatmeal." Norma Wilmer's head goes back and forth. She's like a woman watching a tennis match.
"You don't see what we see after you've left."
Color is rising in Babineau's stubble-flecked cheeks, and there are dark circles under his eyes. Hodges remembers a cartoon from his Sunday school Living with Jesus workbook back in the prehistoric era when cars had fins and girls wore bobby socks. Brady's doc has the same look as the guy in the cartoon, but Hodges doubts if he's a chronic masturbator. On the other hand, he remembers Becky telling him that the neuro doctors are often crazier than the patients. "And what would that be?" Hodges asks. "Little psychic tantrums? Do things have a way of falling over after I'm gone? The toilet in his bathroom flushes by itself, maybe?"
"Ridiculous. What you leave is psychic wreckage, Mr. Hodges. He's not so brain damaged that he doesn't know you're obsessed with him. Malevolently so. I want you to leave. We've had a tragedy, and many of the patients are upset."
Hodges sees Wilmer's eyes widen slightly at this and knows that the patients capable of cognition, many here in the bucket or not, have no idea that the head nurse has offed herself. "I only have a few questions for him, and then I'll be out of your hair." Babineau leans forward. The eyes behind his gold-rimmed glasses are threaded with snaps of red.
"Listen closely, Mr. Hodges. 1, Mr. Hartsfield is not capable of answering your questions. If he could answer questions, he would have been brought to trial for his crimes by now. 2, you have no official standing. 3, if you don't leave now, I will call security and have you escorted from the premises."
Hodges says, "Pardon me for asking, but are you all right?"
Babineau draws back as if Hodges has brandished a fist in his face. "Get out!"
The little clusters of medical personnel stop talking and look around. "Gotcha," Hodges says. "Going. All good." There's a snack alcove near the entrance to the skyway. Intern two is leaning there, hands in pockets.
"Ooh, baby," he says. "You've been schooled."
So it would seem. Hodges studies the wares in the nibble a bit machine. He sees nothing in there that won't set his guts on fire, but that's okay. He's not hungry. "Young man," he says, without turning around, "if you would like to make $50 for doing a simple errand that will cause you no trouble, then get with me." Intern two,
A fellow who looks like he might actually attain adulthood at some point in the not-too-distant future, joins him at the nibble a bit.
What's the errand?
Hodges keeps his pad in his back pocket, just as he did when he was a detective first class. He scribbles two words, "Call me," and adds his cell number. Give this to Norma Wilmer once Smaug spreads his wings and flies away. Intern 2 takes the note and folds it into the breast pocket of his scrubs. Then he looks expectant. Hodges takes out his wallet. 50 is a lot for delivering a note, but he has discovered at least one good thing about terminal cancer. You can toss your budget out the window.
12. Jerome Robinson is balancing boards on his shoulder under the hot Arizona sun when his cell phone rings. The houses they are building, the first two already framed, are in a low-income but respectable neighborhood on the southern outskirts of Phoenix. He puts the boards across the top of a handy wheelbarrow and plucks his phone from his belt, thinking it will be Hector Alonso, the job foreman. This morning, one of the workmen, a workwoman actually, tripped and fell into a stack of rebar. She broke her collarbone and suffered an ugly facial laceration. Alonzo took her to the St. Luke's ER, appointing Jerome temporary foreman in his absence. It's not Alonzo's name he sees in the little window, but Holly Gibney's face. It's a photo he took himself, catching her in one of her rare smiles. "Hey, Holly, how are you? I have to call you back in a few. It's been a crazy morning here, but..."
"I need you to come home," Holly says. She sounds calm, but Jerome knows her of old, and in just those six words he can sense strong emotions held in check, fear chief among them. Holly is still a very fearful person. Jerome's mother, who loves her dearly, once called fear Holly's default setting. "Home? Why? What's wrong?" His own fear suddenly grips him. "Is it my dad? Mom? Is it Barbie?"
"It's Bill," she says. "He has cancer. A very bad cancer. Pancreatic. If he doesn't get treatment, he'll die. He'll probably die anyway, but he could have time, and he told me it was just a little ulcer because...
She takes a great ragged breath that makes Jerome wince.
"Because of Brady fracking Hartsfield."
Jerome has no idea what connection Brady Hartsfield can have to Bill's terrible diagnosis, but he knows what he's seeing right now. Trouble. On the far side of the building site, two hard-hatted young men, Habitat for Humanity College volunteers like Jerome himself, are giving a beeping, backing cement truck conflicting directions. Disaster looms. "Holly, give me 5 minutes and I'll call you back."
"But you'll come, won't you? Say you'll come, because I don't think I can talk to him about this on my own, and he has to get into treatment right away."
"5 minutes, he says, and kills the call. His thoughts are spinning so fast that he's afraid the friction will catch his brains on fire, and the blaring sun isn't helping. Bill? With cancer? On one hand, it doesn't seem possible, but on the other, it seems completely possible. He was in top form during the Pete Sauber's business, where Jerome and Holly partnered with him, but he'll be 70 soon, and the last time Jerome saw him before leaving for Arizona in October, Bill didn't look all that well. Too thin. Too pale. But Jerome can't go anywhere until Hector gets back. It would be like leaving the inmates to run the asylum. And knowing the Phoenix hospitals, where the ERs are overrun 24 hours a day, he may be stuck here until quitting time. He sprints for the cement truck, bawling, "Hold up! Hold up! For Jesus' sake!" at the top of his lungs. He gets the clueless volunteers to halt the cement truck they've been misdirecting less than 3 feet from a freshly dug drainage ditch, and he's bending over to catch his breath when his phone rings again. "Holly, I love you," Jerome thinks, pulling it from his belt once more, "but sometimes you drive me absolutely bugfuck." Only this time, it's not Holly's picture he sees. It's his mother's. Tanya is crying.
"You have to come home," she says, and Jerome has just long enough to think of something his grandfather used to say. Bad luck keeps bad company. It's Barbie, after all.
13.
Hodges is in the lobby and headed for the door when his phone vibrates. It's Norma Wilmer. Is he gone? Hodges asks. Norma doesn't have to ask who he's talking about.
Yes. Now that he's seen his prize patient, he can relax and do the rest of his rounds.
I was sorry to hear about Nurse Capelli. It's true. He didn't care for her, but it's still true.
I was, too. She ran the nursing staff like Captain Bly ran the bounty, but I hate to think of anyone doing that. You get the news, and your first reaction is, oh, no, not her, never. It's the shock of it. Your second reaction is, oh, yes, that makes perfect sense. Never married, no close friends, not that I knew of, anyway. Nothing but the job, where everybody sort of loathed her.
All the lonely people, Hodges says, stepping out into the cold and turning toward the bus stop. He buttons his coat one-handed and then begins to massage his side.
Yes, there are a lot of them. What can I do for you, Mr. Hodges?
I have a few questions. Could you meet me for a drink? There's a long pause. Hodges thinks she's going to tell him no. Then she says,
I don't suppose your questions could lead to trouble for Dr. Babineau.
Anything is possible, Norma.
That would be nice, but I guess I owe you one regardless, for not letting on to him that we know each other from back in the Becky Helmington days. There's a watering hole on Revere Avenue. Got a clever name, Bar Bar Black Sheep, and most of the staff drinks closer to the hospital. Can you find it?
Yeah.
I'm off at 5. Meet me there at 5:30. I like a nice cold vodka martini.
It'll be waiting.
Just don't expect me to get you in to see Hartsfield. It would mean my job. Babineau was always intense, but these days he's downright weird. I tried to tell him about Ruth, and he blew right past me. Not that he's apt to care when he finds out.
Got a lot of love for him, don't you?
She laughs. For that, you owe me 2 drinks.
2 it is. He's slipping his phone back into his coat pocket when it buzzes again. He sees the call is from Tanya Robinson, and his thoughts immediately flash to Jerome, building houses out there in Arizona. A lot of things can go wrong on building sites. He takes the call. Tanya's crying, at first too hard for him to understand what she's saying, only that Jim is in Pittsburgh and she doesn't want to call him until she knows more. Hodges stands at the curb, one palm plastered against his non-phone ear to muffle the sound of traffic.
Slow down, Tanya, slow down. Is it Jerome? Did something happen to Jerome?
No, Jerome's fine. Him I did call. It's Barbara. She was in Lowtown.
What in God's name was she doing in Lowtown and on a school day?
I don't know. All I know is that some boy pushed her into the street and a truck hit her. They're taking her to Kina Memorial. I'm on my way there now.
Are you driving?
Yes, what does that have to do with...
Get off the phone, Tanya, and slow down. I'm at Kiner now. I'll meet you in the ER.
He hangs up and heads back to the hospital, breaking into a clumsy trot. He thinks, this goddamn place is like the mafia. Every time I think I'm out, it pulls me back in.
14. An ambulance with its lights flashing is just backing into one of the ER bays.
Hodges goes to meet it, pulling out the police ID he still keeps in his wallet. When the paramedic and the EMT pull the stretcher out of the back, he flashes the ID with his thumb placed over the red retired stamp. Technically speaking, this is a felony crime, impersonating an officer, and consequently it's a fiddle he uses sparingly, but this time it seems absolutely appropriate. Barbara is medicated, but conscious. When she sees Hodges, she grasps his hand tightly.
Bill, how did you get here so fast? Did Mom call you?
Yeah, how are you?
I'm okay. They gave me something for the pain. They say I have a broken leg. I'm going to miss the basketball season, and I guess it doesn't matter because Mom will ground me until I'm, like, 25.
Tears begin to leak from her eyes. He doesn't have long with her, so questions about what she was doing on MLK Avenue, where there are sometimes as many as 4 drive-by shootings a week, will have to wait. There's something more important. Barb, do you know the name of the boy who pushed you in front of the truck? Her eyes widen. Or get a good look at him. Could you describe him?
Pushed? Oh, no, Bill. No, that's wrong.
Officer, we gotta go.
the paramedic says. You can question her later.
Wait!
Barbara shouts and tries to sit up. The EMT pushes her gently back down, and she's grimacing with pain, but Hodges is heartened by that shout. It was good and strong. What is it, Barb?
He only pushed me after I ran into the street. He pushed me out of the way. I think he might have saved my life, and I'm glad.
She's crying hard now, but Hodges doesn't believe for a minute it's because of her broken leg.
I don't want to die, after all. I don't know what was wrong with me.
We really have to get her in an exam room, Chief, the paramedic says. She needs an X-ray.
Don't let them do anything to that boy,
Barbara calls as the AMBO guys roll her through the double doors.
He's tall. He's got green eyes and a goatee. He goes to Todd Hunter.
She's gone, the doors clapping back and forth behind her. Hodges walks outside, where he can use his cell phone without being scolded, and calls Tanya back. I don't know where you are, but slow down and don't run any red lights getting here. They just took her in and she's wide awake. She has a broken leg.
That's all? Thank God. What about internal injuries?
That's for the doctors to say, but she was pretty lively. I think maybe the truck just grazed her.
I need to call Jerome. I'm sure I scared the hell out of him. And Jim needs to know.
Call them when you get here. For now, get off your phone.
You can call them, Bill.
No, Tanya, I can't. I have to call someone else. He stands there, breathing out plumes of white vapor, the tips of his ears going numb. He doesn't want the someone else to be Pete, because Pete is a tad pissed at him right now, and that goes double for Izzy Janes. He thinks about his other choices, but there's only one, Cassandra Sheen. He partnered up with her several times when Pete was on vacation, and on one occasion when Pete took 6 weeks of unexplained personal time. That was shortly after Pete's divorce, and Hodges surmised he was in a spin-dry center, but never asked, and Pete never volunteered the information. He doesn't have Cassie's cell number, so he calls Detective Division and asks to be connected, hoping she's not in the field. He's in luck. After less than 10 seconds of McGruff the crime dog, she's in his ear. Is this Cassie Sheen, the Botox queen?
Billy Hodges, you old whore. I thought you were dead.
Soon enough, Cassie, he thinks. I'd love to bullshit with you, hon, but I need a favor. They haven't closed the Strike Avenue station yet, have they?
Nope. It's on the docket for next year, though, which makes perfect sense. Crime in Lowtown? What crime, right?
Yeah, safest part of the city. They may have a kid in for booking, and if my information is right, he deserves a medal instead.
Got a name?
No, but I know what he looks like. Tall, green eyes, goatee. He replays what Barbara said and adds, he could be wearing a Todd Hunter high jacket. The arresting officers probably have him for pushing a girl in front of a truck. He actually pushed her out of the way, so she only got clipped instead of mashed.
You know this for a fact?
Yeah. This isn't quite the truth, but he believes Barbara. Find out his name and ask the cops to hold him, okay? I want to talk to him.
I think I can do that.
Thanks, Cassie. I owe you one. He ends the call and looks at his watch. If he means to talk to the Todd Hunter kid and still keep his appointment with Norma, time is too tight to be messing around with the city bus service. One thing, Barbara said, keeps replaying in his mind.
I don't want to die, after all. I don't know what was wrong with me.
He calls Holly.